Today's podcast is brought to you by the 2018 Creative Nonfiction Writers Conference. Now in its sixth year, the CNF Writers Conference is 3 days of celebrating the art, craft, and business of writing true stories. May 24th through the 26th in downtown Pittsburgh. Details at creativenonfiction.org/conference. Listeners of the show receive 20% off the registration price by entering coupon code CNFPODCAST, all one word, during checkout. Promotional support is also provided by Hippo Campus Magazine. Its 2018 Remember in November contest for creative nonfiction is open for submissions until July 15th. This annual contest has a grand prize of $1,000 and publication for all finalists. That's awesome. Visit hippocampusmagazine.com for details. Hippocampus Magazine, memorable creative nonfiction. Let's do the show. Oh boy, CNFers, it's episode 100 of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. 100? Here for the first time? This is my jam, the show where I speak to the best artists about telling true stories, leaders in narrative journalism, memoir, documentary film, radio, and personal essay, to tease out tactics, habits, origins, and routines so you can improve your own work. I'm your host, Brendan O'Mara. Hey. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your pods and share with a fellow CNF buddy. And man, are you serious? 100 episodes, and for this special occasion, we here at CNF Pod HQ bring you the one, the only, Mary Carr. I'm sure 99.9% of you know who she is, but if you don't, here's the rundown. She's the best-selling author of The Liars Club, Cherry, Lit, The Art of Memoir, and 5 books of poetry, including her latest, Tropic of Squalor, published by Harper. Mary is a professor at Syracuse University and is best known and most responsible for the boom in memoir when The Liars Club kicked all our asses and showed us what a personal story could be. We talked a lot about the importance of patience, working through dozens of drafts, the nature of talent, and cellos. Yes, cellos. She's at Mary Carr Lit on Twitter and Facebook, and her website is marycarr.com. Be sure to stick through to the very, very end of the show where Mary reads 2 amazing poems from Tropic of Squalor. You don't want to miss out on that tasty goodness. I had a blast speaking with her, and I hope you enjoy listening. Let's waste no more time. Here's episode 100 with Mary Carr. Very nice. Well, like I said, yes. What was kind of cool, like I tweeted out yesterday to you that that I've read Tropic of Squalor, cover to cover 3 times, and
oh, so nice.
And it's wonderful. It's one of those books that just seems to get a bit richer every time you do it, and it's nice to be sort of in the hands of someone who really knows what they're doing, and it's just such a lovely piece of work, and I want to thank you for it.
Oh, it's so kind of you. It's just, oh, it's the nicest. It's the nicest. It's all you want to hear. I mean, it's all you want to hear. So
yeah,
thank you. I've been surprisingly lucky with it.
Yeah, it's luck, of course, doesn't have a whole lot to do with it. You know, this thing is a grind and a craft, and what you're able to distill with what you're writing, it's so lean and so like beautiful and powerful. And so what does that process look like for you as you're looking to just squeeze the most out of every single word?
Well, I think the way I try to describe it to my students who are, obviously engaged in the page, I throw out a lot, but I have a tendency to rewrite, like completely overhaul. A friend of mine said, it's like you buy a hatchet from Abraham Lincoln and, 100 years later, you have to change the head, and 100 years after that, you have to change the handle, And so I feel like that's most every poem in there started out. I always make a joke that every poem I've ever written is "I Am Sad, the End" by Mary Carr. Like it's usually comes out of grief or rage or joy or some strong feeling. And then you just try to be, the poems aren't for me, they're supposed to be for readers. So I just try to make an experience for a reader is what I'm shooting for.
And at first, I've heard Neil Strauss say something like, the first draft is for me and the second draft is for the reader and the third draft is for the haters. And so,
that's such a great line.
Isn't that cool? And
so good.
Yeah. And he's doing, you know, reported nonfiction and so forth. But I wonder if on, right. on some level, if that kind of hits home for you, that maybe your early drafts are for you, but then there's a conscientious effort for the reader. And then, you know, just that kind of honing as you're rewriting things.
You know, I almost always have a very specific reader in mind. It might be a very literary person, somebody I admire a lot, somebody I'm afraid is going to read it. I think I often go to like the scariest place I can go. I think, you know, there's a chance Don DeLillo could read this poem. And then, you know, if it's terrible, I'll have to, you know, lie down on the train track. But it's more like the drafts 3 to draft 50 are for the haters. I really do literally do like 50 drafts of a poem, like the things that are sonnets started out being, you know, 2 pages, single space. So I just try to hack away stuff that's really boring or really obvious or the language really, everybody has a sin they commit as a writer. I always want to think I'm clever, which I'm not particularly. I mean, there are plenty of much cleverer people than I am. But so I often find myself cutting out things where I'm trying to be glib or steer away from what was difficult.
Mm-hmm. And is that usually a trusted reader tells you that, or is it something that you stumble upon? You're like, oh yeah, you know, Mary, you're trying to be, you know, too clever in this instance. Work harder.
Right, right. When I was about 12, I all the kids in the sixth grade picked on me because I was reading T.S. Eliot, and I started saying indeed because I was an asshole. Because let me say, I started saying indeed because I was a horrible person. Can I say asshole on this show?
Oh yeah. You can say anything you want.
Okay. So I thought I sounded like a dick. And but that was like one of those poets, those European influenced American poets who descended kind of from the French, fancy French symbolist poets who ate opium and drank absinthe and, you know, boffed hookers by the boatload. And, you know, they were smarter than everybody else. And they kind of teased the bourgeois reader with difficulty. Mm. And I think that's not the nature of my ability. Whatever I bring to the page is usually much more about heart or about connecting with people. So while that's a perfectly fine way to write, and that's a perfectly, that tradition has influenced poetry in English the past 170 years or 50, 60 years, I guess.
To your point, it's like, what was that process like for you? And you write about, you've always, you know, written about the nature of talent, finding voice. And I wonder, what was that process like going from someone who felt like they had to say indeed to someone who was comfortable writing horse dookie?
horse dookie. You know, an even better one is horse hockey, but a lot of Yankees don't know what it means. But horse hockey, isn't that a good one?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think when I got sober, which I did before my second book of poems, I literally typed up my second book of poems in a mental institution. I was in the hallway with a typewriter for certain hours a day that would let me type. And I think I was living in Boston and around Cambridge where everybody was such a smarty pants. And I think I had surrendered. I had surrendered to the idea that while I was a, you know, little pit bull, and I would try very hard, and I would read everything. I was not, I didn't go to the Sorbonne. I didn't speak seven languages, and I don't know. I think as we get older, I don't know, you sound young, but as we get older, we become, in my 60s, you become more and more yourself.
Right.
Kind of almost, you know, it can be a really bad thing. I think for me, in terms of my writing, it's been, I feel freer to say what I want.
And how long would you say it took you to come to that and to be comfortable being who you were on the page versus trying to imitate somebody else that was an early influence?
I would say I really started writing when I was a kid. I mean, like five. But I started writing a lot kind of on a schedule when I was about 19 or 20. So maybe 35. Mm-hmm. It was, so what is that? 15 years,
yeah.
I think. And it's just that, you know, the Carnegie, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? You know, practice, practice, practice. I just wrote a lot, and I don't think everybody should go to an MFA program or sit in a workshop, but I was somebody who really profited. I had a great teacher, a guy named Etheridge Knight. I think I write about him in Lit, who was this African-American, rusty-handed ex-con who Gwendolyn Brooks had discovered in, I think, in prison in Michigan at the time, though he was from Mississippi. And he moved across, say, the Princeton campus like a man from Mississippi and not like somebody impersonating an intellectual. He was an autodidact and he was self-educated and he was also a brilliant poet. And I remember him taking a pencil and tapping my shoulder with it, like, your heart, Mary Carr, your heart.
Mm.
You know, you're not going to be a philosopher. And I was thinking, of course I'll be a philosopher. I had these very grand ideas with my little redneck squirrel murdering self. But then I also had teachers who were, you know, Robert Haas or Louise Glick or Heather McHugh, who, you know, were part of the academy, who went to the schools with the fancy names. But actually Louise was a dropout. Tobias Wolff was a dropout. I think I naturally migrated towards people who were not coming out of the academy, even though I met them in graduate school, sort of in the academy. But nobody, when I was in graduate school, I wasn't the one that everybody said, oh, she's really going to do something. I think I was lauded or rewarded for being a little bit of a workhorse, for reading more books than other people did, because I was so behind when I got there. I was so miserably educated, mainly from having dropped out of school. I mean, you know, through no fault of my teachers, from being just such a feckless, you know, itinerant. I got honors, I think, every semester I was there, but it was not really for the writing. It was much more for being, you know, doing more essays than everybody did and really trying to learn something about history, because I really didn't know anything written before Elvis, you know?
Right. I wonder where you got that strength of and conviction of patience through that 15-year sort of apprenticeship that you underwent, through having to read more than everyone else to catch up and to write more than everyone else to catch up. You know, where did that doggedness come from?
Again, I had some amazing teachers, but I also didn't really have anything to go back to, did I? I mean, what was I going to do? I was going to go to work at the brewery. I was going to, I don't know, maybe I could have gotten an education degree and taught high school English or something like that. I mean, in the best case scenario, but, you know, most of the pathways I took were very unconventional. So, I think there was that doggedness. I think I worked very closely with Robert Haas when I was in grad school, and he read Pound and Elliot and Stevens with me and was kind of an expert on all of them. And so I remember when I was reading Pound, I went to the library and tried to look up every word in the cantos, you know, that's used, is written in like, you know, 14 different languages, including ancient Greek and Sanskrit. And I thought I was going to look up every word I didn't know and understand the cantos. And I called him at home and I was crying from the phone booth and because I couldn't afford a phone. And I said, you know, Bob, I can't read the cantos. And he's like, well, then don't read them. And he urged me to think about the sound of the poems. You know, he said, why don't you try to learn how to pronounce French and Italian instead of learning all these different languages just in the short term? You can learn how to pronounce stuff in about a month. You know, why don't you just do that? So suddenly I began to, he gave me things I could do that made me less afraid of kind of the monolithic task of trying to educate myself. But it was also, I guess when I was a little kid, writers were kind of the way, you know, guys in Texas feel about the Dallas Cowboys, you know.
Yeah.
I thought about, you know, some great athlete. Writers were just so, they were like unicorns or griffins or centaurs or something. They were just so glamorous, and that especially poets who could do something in such a small, with such economy, you know, just a small page, a handful of words, they could really knock the bejesus out of you. So it was two things. I think it was a combination of loneliness and devotion. They spoke to me. They made me less lonely, both on the page. And then I met them, and they're peculiar. And they were kind of peculiar in ways that I was peculiar. They were solitary. They were smart and fun to talk to, but they didn't brook a lot of nonsense.
It seems it must have been kind of empowering to see that everyone kind of ran their own race, but ended up kind of in a similar place. Like, it didn't have to be a singularly charted map. Like, you found all these kind of quirky roads that everyone took to the same place, and then you realize you're sort of among your own people.
And they were, you know, they were, it's not like anybody said, oh, you're going to be a great poet. It wasn't like that. I wasn't encouraged like that, but just to be part of the conversation, just to be in a room where people were talking about poetry. Not just the great writers like Louise Gluck or Robert Haas or Etheridge Knight, but, you know, just my fellow students, you know, who were, you know, Mark Doty was in grad school with me, and just meeting young poets and young authors. I felt so lucky. You know, I grew up in this town where you couldn't buy a book. And here were these people who, like me, would, you know, forego buying groceries to load up a paper sack at a used bookstore. It just seemed marvelous.
Yeah, and more nourishing in a sense.
Yeah, and that's where the patience came from. It was, what else was I going to do? Was I going to be suddenly, like, get a job as a secretary somewhere? I mean, I'm not competent. I would be worse at that than I was at this.
In one of your recent poems, you know, read these, you had mentioned, you know, his loneliness was an invisible crown. And then there was a tweet you sent out not too long ago that, you know, I write for the same reason I read, to find a better way of being alone. And I loved how you phrased that, and that it's not eschewing loneliness at all, but having these words and a capacity for language and reading the stuff, it allows you to, you know, to be solitary and, like you said, a better way to be alone. So, like, how did you arrive at that comfort that this was, like you said, a better way to be alone?
Well, even when I was a little girl, I think, and I lived in this household where there were bullet holes in the wall, and I mean, plenty of people grew up worse than I did. But the older I get, the worse my childhood seems to me. I think it didn't seem as bad to me when I was closer to it, and now when I just think about any of the things that happened to me that, you know, could never have happened to my son. I remember asking once, were you afraid of my mother? Because she had threatened to slap him. And he said, oh, you would never allow that to happen. And even when I was a kid and I was depressed and really to the point of suicide when I was under 10 and insecure and lonely, reading was socially sanctioned disassociation. I could disappear down the valley of a book, and you know, Eeyore and Winnie the Pooh and Piglet were my friends. It's really kind of pitiful when you think about it, but it imbued the process. It became a place of comfort to me, and has never stopped being that. It, you know, has never stopped being a marvel to me. Words on a page.
You titled the first part of Lit, Escaping from the Tropic of Squalor, and the title of the new collection, of course, is The Tropic of Squalor. And I wanted to know, maybe what made you want to return to that title in that place?
Well, a lack of imagination, I guess. It is a great title, just as titles go.
Yeah.
And I was still haunted by the place, by the physical place, you know, those poems about Texas and about my father. And I wanted it to be a book like Dante, you know, starts in the inferno and then works his way to paradise. And I feel like I started in the darkness of this swampy hellhole with these surrounded by these flaming towers, and New York City, it could be its own hell, certainly, but for me, it's my paradiso. It is amazing. I mean, last night I gave this reading, and it was like standing room only at a bookstore. It was shocking. And at the end, there was a guy right on the front row who was pretty clearly homeless, and, you know, didn't have teeth, as it turns out, which no one else could see but me and the people right next to him. But I asked for questions, and he said, you know, don't you have any happy poems? And I said, but not very many. And he said, why not? And I'm like, I don't know, you know, I guess I'm a sad person, you know, but, you know, happiness writes white or something. But he was just a guy who'd wandered in to get off the street and have a place to sit down. And we were having a conversation about the nature of art and what it's for. You know, if I lived in Peoria, or, you know, I might not have that kind of conversation as I could have on Broadway and 82nd Street last night. So,
yeah. And what's the process like of choosing which poems make the cut for something like this, and then tracking it like an album? Like, what is that like for you in terms of the order?
That's exactly how I think of it. I have a lot of friends who are musicians. Even when I was a kid, you know, I was one of those girls who dated the guitar player, you know. So I often think of like a fast song and a slow song. For the first half of the book, before you get to the less than holy Bible part, I thought about starting. I don't know. I always, the poem ends with my friend Dean Young, who's a great poet. And he was dying. He actually got a heart transplant and didn't die, but his mouth was blue because he didn't have enough oxygen and his heart was failing. And, we come across this dying squirrel and he bent like a waiter to the squirrel and said, with no irony at all, you know, I honor your struggle, little brother. it was such a crazy sweet thing to say. And so I thought, as an opening, I wanted everything else in the book to be about honoring, you know, my struggle, certainly, but everybody's. But eventually I lay everything out. What it looks like is I lay it out around my apartment. Like, I think, well, this poem probably goes at the end. Like, that's what I think. And then the Less Than Holy Bible, I had been working on for a while, all these poems that I wanted to be like a journey from, specifically from the Inferno to Paradise, and from the void, from Genesis, into some kind of resurrection or something. So I thought, well, okay, well then these poems that are more exalted or about a more obvious redemption have to come later. And so then how do you build up to the, you know, I tried to make some kind of arc or narrative.
Yeah, I love picturing you moving these poems around physically to get us to really see it visually and have your hands on it and to, you know, see how that map plays out and see if it makes any sense.
You know, I do that with my thesis students at Syracuse University, where I teach. They, when I work with an MFA student at the end of the semester, when they're about to graduate, they come to my apartment in New York, and we lay out, one of them will come and we'll just, so one of them was just here and we were laying out his poems all around my apartment, and he was standing in the middle and he was moving one way and I was moving another, and we were sort of shuffling everything around, and he stood in the middle and held his hands up. I wish you could see Jacob Meyer. He's such a beautiful kid. And he said, "I feel like I'm in the middle of a whirlpool." Just, it was so funny. So sweet.
It's great that you brought up your friend Dean too. That was one of the things I wanted to talk about, especially with, you know, how all the poems kind of link together. Cause you started with, you know, the organ donor's driver's license has a black check. And then later there's Dear Oklahoma Team Smashed on Reservation Road. And I wanted to get a sense of like your relationship to Dean and maybe what happened to him, but he kind of alluded to that already. But so like who is Dean, and like, you know, what's your relationship with him?
Well, there are two poets right now. Well, there are three really that I feel kind of the greatest admiration for there are a million, actually there are probably four, but certainly in the top two, it kind of ping pongs back between Terrence Hayes and Dean Young. Mm-hmm. So he's a guy, I've known his work for a long time, but he published a book called Skid maybe 15 years ago, 13 years ago, and it just knocked my socks off. It just came at me at a time that really wowed me. And I was like, I have to meet this guy. So we wound up teaching in a summer program at Sarah Lawrence and became kind of best friends just as he was dying. He began to die. I mean, he was dying. Before they found a donor heart, he was, you know, he was on the list and he might have died before that happened. And so he lives in Austin, teaches at University of Texas. And I went down there shortly after, well, before the surgery, when I was afraid he was going to die, and then after. So he's just also somebody, like anybody who's really looked into the abyss, the poems really changed from facing his own mortality. I saw him as he's no Richard Simmons, you know, he's a dark bastard. that's who Dean is. So
a couple of the other poems that I wanted to talk to you about that I thought were just so like prescient and moving were the Carnegie Hall Rush Seats. And you know, the cello has always kind of been something that kind of just bellows and is always like cut into my core, if you will. And I love the way you put it, is that it just kind of it aches. And I wanted to ask you, what has been your experience, maybe, you know, listening to music like that, and why specifically maybe does the cello speak to you so much so that, you know, you wrote a poem about it?
Well, that's so interesting. I used to date this kind of famous concert pianist, named Awadajan Pratt. We're good friends now. It was long, long ago. So a couple of times I would go with him on the road, and I would go to where he was playing. And I used to joke, because he was very kind of handsome guy. I used to joke that at every orchestra, there was some bow-legged cello player, you know, looking at me who had some woman playing the cello who hated me. And I would show up at rehearsal and we would joke about the bow-legged cello player. But like you, I'm one of those people, every time I hear the cello, it's like the hair, you know, on the back of my neck crawls up my scalp. And then Pratt actually put out a record with a famous cellist and that I listened to kind of over and over. And I was thinking, what is it about that noise? What is it about? It's so mournful, but there's something so, it makes you feel so alive. And so, yeah, I guess I thought it was sexual, and I thought it was, you know, also about balancing on the edge of a pit, you know, about being, you know, right at the edge of the darkness, right at the, you know, a tree's had its heart hacked out to make the instrument. I don't know. I guess all those associations. But that poem was about four times longer than it is now. And it became so much better when I just cut all the blubber off it. But thank you for saying that. I got so much mail. It ran in the New Yorker, actually. And I got so much mail about it. It was so nice.
Yeah. Well, it's like you say, cutting the blubber off it. I mean, almost everything can benefit from being like 10, 20, 30% shorter than it is, if not shorter than that. It's just the nature of word economy, that things should be the shortest possible piece of work that they can be, whether that's an 80,000 word memoir manuscript or a 150 word poem.
Right. Well, you said, are you a poet or a memoir person? I can't tell.
I'm more of a narrative journalist and personal essay and memoir guy myself. I've historically been kind of
great.
I'm sorry. Yep.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I've historically been sort of poem averse, but I've been trying to open my mind to it by reading really, really good poets like yourself. And that's like been opening the door a crack to some, to other things that I haven't been quite as familiar for, because I've just kind of closed my mind to it. So I'm just trying to, you know, be a little more diverse in my reading across all things, because there's a true story component to poetry that I like, and a word economy that appeals to me.
Right. Well, if you try somebody, just between you and me, if you try somebody like Dean Young, he's kind of an experimental poet, as is Terence Hayes, my other sort of favorite American poet right now, Hayes. They're both experimental, which means the poems aren't all, you're not going to like all the poems, and you're not crazy. The poems vary to me wildly, and they have a lower batting average than somebody who's working in a more traditional way. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
So I think a lot of people, when they read poetry, if they're dealing with a kind of bolder person than I am, the poems that are great are better than heroin. But you just have to trust yourself when you hit one that you don't like, to say, you know, there's nothing wrong with me. This is just, it's working in a way that I can't enter it. I don't know. So that's interesting. But I also think that nonfiction essays right now are really enjoying a renaissance. Last night, a lot of people were talking about them.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of getting back to the cello. Have you read Jose Saramago's Death with Interruptions?
Absolutely.
That novel, I just love it. It's one of my favorite books of the last 15 years, well, 10 years, I guess. And the way he writes about the cello and that, like, kind of like when I read yours, I'm like, oh, that kind of echoed back to the way he handled the cello piece, or the cello aspect of that book. And that's great that you've read it, so you kind of have a touchstone there.
Yeah, he's just such a genius, isn't he?
Yeah. Oh man, that harkened back to that for me. And what I also like in Tropical Squalor was the like button. And that seemed kind of dystopic, especially in our age of social media, and how it can kind of, how our validation comes comes so much from people liking a tweet or liking a post on Facebook or something. Like, where did that poem come from and surface from for you?
Well, I tell people all the time I can sort of gauge my spiritual state by how much I want to kill my fellow New Yorkers. And so I actually do a spiritual exercise that I kind of made up that a Buddhist friend of mine says, a Tibetan Buddhist friend says, is an actual meditation practice, which is when I am very irritated, and I'm walking through the city, I'm in a big crowd, I start praying for each face. Mm. You know, God bless, you know, the guy in the plaid shirt. God bless the woman screaming, you know, in a pile of excrement. God bless the, you know, whatever. And instantly people kind of look different to me. What did that? I was apropos of something. Remind me your question again.
Oh, just
it fell out of my head.
Oh yeah, it dealt with how in this age, like, so much of our validation is drawn from that little dopamine.
Oh, right.
Yeah, from the like.
Right. So what started happening was that people who used to look horrible to me began to look beautiful to me. They I mean, just try this, honestly. Even if you don't believe in God, just say, bless this person. Mm-hmm. When you're in a crowd and you're being irritated, you're in line for, you know, at the airport or whatever. And people actually start to look different. They become more specific and they become less whatever category you put them in. And I thought, based on the social media thing, that wouldn't it be great if we evolved that button on our heads and we stopped liking the Kardashians and started liking, you know, the unfortunate, the suffering, enough to the poor, enough to kind of maybe, you know, take care of them a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I caught, yeah, the reference to like the glass on the, on her ass. I was like, oh yeah, there's that. But then.
I know. Well, right.
Yeah.
You know, she's such an irritant to me because I've never clicked on a single thing having to do with any of them. And I see their faces every day, probably 5 times.
Oh man. It's just, like the algorithms are still somehow pointing her to you.
Yeah. What kind of filter do I have to put on my phone to stop having such people fly at me, you know?
Oh man. I wish I knew, Mary, because there, though, certain things that just keep popping up. Like, there are other people that I want to see pop up in my various feeds. I'm like, wait, where are they? Did they disappear? But no, I keep getting stuff about the Avengers. So
I know the Avengers. It's so funny. It's very funny.
And in your writing process, like, where do you feel most engaged and most alive?
In terms of writing?
Yeah, writing or rewriting or the editing phase, you know, what part sort of like excites you the most?
Definitely editing. I'm definitely a better rewriter. I'm not much of a writer, but I'm a pretty good rewriter. I can make things better. I'm able to make things better if I can get through the horribleness of the first draft. I've got a chance, I think. So, yeah. And for me, it's getting everything I really want to say has barnacles on it. I think I try to, even after all this time, I try to hide and I don't do it on purpose. I want to tell the truth, but I'm ashamed of myself in some way. So I still bob and weave and hide and dodge and faint and only with time can I kind of actually unearth or, you know, find the angel in the stone, as Michelangelo would have said.
Mm. And you came to a high degree of visibility with your work, you know, around the age of 40 or so. And
right.
And so what advice might you give someone who might be mid-career, has a little bit of talent or a lot of talent, but things just haven't clicked yet?
What would I say to somebody in that situation? I mean, I really profited from a writing group, from a work, you know, from workshops, and to not be afraid to take edits. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, a lot of young writers in my classes argue with me. I will edit something for them and they'll argue with me. And I understand that they have an idea about it, but I think the younger and more uncertain the writer, the more fiercely they defend an original idea. And one of my students said, well, how many edits do you take? What kind of, how are you at taking edits? I said, probably, I don't know, I probably take 98% of the suggested edits.
Mm-hmm.
Even the ones I rankle against from an editor, or even somebody in a magazine, or even some that I rankle against. So I would say to not be afraid to rewrite. It's not like painting where people literally have an idea that you can break the poem or break the piece of writing if you tear it to, but you can always go back to an earlier draft and you can paint past something and ruin it forever. Mm. But a writer can all, you know, you can tear it apart and try to do it another way and always go back to an earlier draft if you're not happy. But I've just found in the tearing apart, I often see truths that were evading me with some earlier version.
Yeah, the right answer, if someone's willing to give you such great edits, is thank you. It's not to push back against it.
Well, I was the same way.
Yeah.
I was the same way. And I recently asked DeLillo, and he said, I take most edits. Yeah, I take most edits.
We're kind of coming up against our time. I was wondering if maybe you'd feel if you're willing, is there a particular poem out of your collection you wouldn't mind reading?
I'll read the Carnegie Hall poem if that's the one you want, or the Voice of God poem. I think those are two kind of shortish poems.
Sure, that'd be that would be wonderful.
Okay, I'm trying to think which of those. I'll do the Carnegie Hall rush seat. No, I'll do the Voice of God because I'm a prayer. I pray, and even before I believed in God, I started praying. Just like I said before, just in that blind way, almost just like, God, help me, mm-hmm. almost like cursing at the sky. And I pray for people who are sick, and you know, I don't know if it changes things, but it changes me, and sometimes I change things. So, but I actually ask God for advice. I say, like, what should I do about, and even though I never get any lottery numbers or anything good, I do sometimes get a leaning. And people have asked me what the Voice of God sounds like to me as a prayer. And so this poem has kind of been an answer to that. The Voice of God. 90% of what's wrong with you could be cured with a hot bath, says God through the manhole covers. But you want magic to win the lottery you never bought a ticket for. Tenderly, the monks chant, embrace the suffering. The voice never panders, offers no five-year plan, no long-term solution, no edicts from a cloudy white beard hooked over the ears. It is small and fond and local. Don't look for your initials in the geese honking overhead or to see through the glass even darkly. It says the most obvious shit, like, put down that gun. You need a sandwich.
That's great.
But I'm also happy to read the Carnegie Hall if you prefer that, and pick which one you like.
I'd love, yeah, if you could read the Carnegie Hall one too, that'd be wonderful. I would use both.
Okay, since that's the one you brought up. Carnegie Hall rush seats. Yeah, I my friend Awadodge and Pratt, I used to follow around to rehearsals, and always when I heard a cello, I felt like I was floating on hashish smoke or something. So this poem is called Carnegie Hall Rush Seats. Whatever else the orchestra says, the cello insists you're dying. It speaks from the core of the tree's hacked out heart, shaped and smoothed like a woman. Be glad you are not hardwood yourself and can hear it. Every day the cello is taken into someone's arms, taken between spread legs and lured into its shivering. The arm saws and saws, and all the sacred cries of saints and demons issue from the carved cleft holes. Like all of us, it aches, sending up moans from the pit we balance on the edge of.
Wow, that's one. That's
there you
one.
Go.
That's so great. That you did that, Mary. I really appreciate you doing that. I could speak to you for another 3 hours, but I know we're up against our time. So, but
I feel the same way. Well, thank you so much for making time for a harmless book of poems.
Yeah, well, I think it's
I appreciate it.
Of course. Where can people get more familiar with your work online if for some reason they haven't heard of you and your work and want to plug into what you're doing?
Yes. Well, let's see, on Facebook, I think it's Mary Carr Litt. I think that's right. And Twitter, Mary Carr, K-A-R-R Litt, L-I-T. There is a website, marycarr.com, that has those feeds on them, but I'm in the process of updating it, so it's a little dated.
Well, fantastic. Well, Mary, thank you so much again. Thank you so much for your work, and hopefully we'll be able to keep in touch down the line, and thanks again.
I really appreciate it. Thank you, dear. You have a good weekend.
You as well. Take care.
Okay. Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Do I need to ask you how great that was? Thanks to you, friends, for listening. And of course, thanks to Mary for the time and her awesome work. Thanks also to the Creative Nonfiction Conference for sponsoring the show, as well as to Hippocampus Magazine for the promotional support. If you head over to brendanomera.com, you'll find show notes, as well as a chance to subscribe to my monthly reading list newsletter. And no, if you click through and buy any of the books, I don't get any kickback, so you can rest assured that I'm selecting books that I enjoyed and get no compensation for. Once a month, no spam. You can't beat that. You can also support the podcast by leaving a review on iTunes, as that helps our little corner of the internet get a little bit bigger. If you leave an honest review and send me a screenshot, I'll coach up a piece of your work of up to 2,000 words. No diggity. I am at Brendan O'Mara on Twitter and Instagram. The podcast is at CNFPod on Twitter and at CNFPodcast on Facebook. Find it wherever you like. Like it. Engage. Got any questions or concerns? Feel free to reach out. That's going to do it, CNFers. Here's to the next 100 CNF and shows in your ears. I'm Brendan O'Mara. Let's do it again next week. See you later.